All right, so let's go on to tip number five. That's what we're going to do in the last hour, tips number five and six. Number five is learn to tell our story as a story. Number five is to tell our story. So at some stage, we're still thinking, well, how can I tell my friends about Jesus? Well, again, it's baby steps, baby steps. We've done coffee, dinner, gospel. Sooner or later, they're always going to ask you, well, tell me about your faith. You've asked them about their faith, how they became a Buddhist or how they became an atheist. The question they will always ask you is, how did you become a Christian? That's the question they will ask you. Tell me about your faith. Were you always a Christian? How did you become a Christian? And that's when you say, I grew up in a Christian family. I knew Jesus as long as I can remember, but I had to make a decision for myself at the age of 16. No, that's not what we say, because that is Christian jargon. That's Christian code. It's a really fast, efficient way of summarizing your whole life in code, which only Christians can understand. For non-Christians who have no overlap with that, you've lost them. They have stopped listening the instant you said, I grew up in a Christian family. They are not listening to anything you say after that. So we need to learn to tell our story as a story. I often joke because I used to teach in a Bible college, and Bible colleges once a year they go on this mission, they go to churches, they run evangelistic events, and you never trust the Bible college student with the actual talk. So you ask the student, hey, can you give a testimony? Testimony's safe. So these students always write their testimonies out, and then when they give them, they all sound exactly the same. So I often wonder, like if a student was asked to give a testimony and they got up and they thought, oh my gosh, I forgot to bring my testimony, they could actually go to one of the other students, can I borrow yours? And, and you could read it out and it would work, because it's been so depersonalized. We're just saying the code words, the red flag words, which only make sense to Christians, but to non-Christians, it's not real, it's not personal, it's not an experience, it's actually not your life, it's just Christian code. So what I'm going to do over the next half hour is help us to learn to tell our story as a story. And storytellers always use a storytelling grid. So I'm going to teach you a very basic storytelling grid. And you're going to ask, are we allowed to do that? Yes, the Bible uses a storytelling grid, which I'm going to show you. And we too can use storytelling grids. And a friend of mine taught me this. He's a missionary in China. I can't mention his name on a recording, but he's a missionary in China. And he taught me the Greek rule of threes. For the Greeks, everything works better in threes, and we still use the Greek rule of threes. Everything works better in threes. Red, white, blue, blood, sweat, tears. There was an Englishman, there was an Irishman, and there was an Australian. Everything's in threes. So in storytelling, there's a rule of threes as well. So basically, there are three parts to a story. All right, and the first part is the introduction. The second part is the body. The final part is the conclusion. And then the transition points are just as important. So the transition from the introduction to the body, this is where we define the mission. We define the mission. The transition from the body to the conclusion, that's the bridge moment. And the final part, it's a French word. I failed French after 1 year, but it's called the denouement. And I always run out of room. So here it is. Which means the new norm or the unveiling, something like that. All right, so look at how it works. So in the introduction is always where you meet the characters. So we see this in romantic comedies. Introduction, the boy meets the girl meets the boy. The characters are introduced. Now we define the mission. They need to get together. They need to be a couple. They need to fall in love. And bit by bit, through the body, more and more, bit by bit, they come closer and closer. They're just about to fall in love. And then there's a bridge moment. The boy loses the girl. Then there's a montage. And the boy's thinking, do I love her? Do I not love her? Do I not love her? Do I love her? And then you hit the conclusion, yes, I do. I love her. And then there's got to be the make or break moment. Climb a mountain, swim an ocean, catch a train. Find the girl, say you love her. Oh, and they're together. And then there's the denouement, the new norm, what's the new life look like, where it's the two of them in a new life together. So there's a final scene of them together. We see this in James Bond movies. In the introduction, there's always a chase. James is chasing a bad guy. They catch the bad guy. He usually, just as he's about to die, defines the mission. There's a bigger bad guy out there who wants world domination. Oh my gosh, we need to stop this bad guy. That's the mission. So in the body, they get closer and closer and closer to the bad guy. James and the girl finally enter the evil guy's lair, and then they're captured. So that's the bridge moment. Why they captured, that allows the evil guy to monologue. So that recaps the body, that sums up everything that's happened before, and now lets you move forward for the conclusion. The conclusion happens. James and the girl blow up the bad guy's lair, because that's Hollywood. Every loose end is wrapped up in an explosion. Bang! There's an explosion. That's done. It's all wrapped up. And then there's a denouement. You know, the final scene, usually James and the girl together kissing on a boat. This works well, works in sports movies as well. In the introduction, you meet the team, lovable losers, they're not going anywhere. Oh no, but there's a tournament they must win, either to save the city or it's a final deed for their dying mother. So that's the mission. The body now, they have to fulfill the mission. They find a coach, usually some lovable loser, dead-end coach with a past he's trying to forget. And then bit by bit, they get closer and closer. And suddenly there's this moment, oh no, are we good enough? We're not good enough. And someone says, yes, we are, we're good enough. Believe we can do this. And then the bridge moment, there's a training montage. They're training, training, training. And then ding, 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 ding. We come to the conclusion. They're in the tournament. Even here, there's a group rule of threes. They're up in the first bit, down in the second bit, and then by the end they win, they win, they win in the third bit, and there's a denouement, the new life for the team. The Bible uses this storytelling grid. Think of the Gospels. In the introduction, we meet Jesus. He's born, he's a little boy. But then he gets baptized by John the Baptist. That defines the mission. He's to save the sins of the world. And in the synoptics, bit by bit, in the body, he gets closer and closer to Jerusalem. He enters Jerusalem. That's a bridge moment. Suddenly, there's a moment of doubt. Can I do this? Do I want this? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Lord, not your will, not my will, but yours be done. That's the Garden of Gethsemane moment. And then ding, 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 ding. He gets crucified. He rises from the dead. That's the conclusion. That's a bang. That's the explosion. And then there's a denouement where he appears with his disciples one last time and sends them out into the world. That's the new norm. So that's the Greek rule of threes. And Christian music uses it. So introduction, verse one, verse two. You hit the body, that's where they give you the chorus. And the verse, back it off, chorus. And then and they drop the instruments, let the girl sing. And then now you go, now you have the bridge. You just hit the moment. No, let's pull it back. Let's bridge it. 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 And then conclusion. Chorus, chorus, chorus. And then denouement, the music leader prays. And that's it. We're all back to normal. All right. So how can we use this in our testimony? Well, you've got to introduce yourself. Who are you? Meet the character. Who am I? You know, like, and then you've got to define the mission. What is your mission in life? What is your existential drive? What are your dreams? What are your hopes? What are your ambitions? What must you have to have a happy ending in your life? What is driving you? Again, who are you? So when I taught my Bible college students how to write their testimony as a story, most of us needed 1 hour staring at a blank page working out the introduction. Like, who am I? Really, who am I? What are my emotions? What are my dreams? What are my hopes? What drives me? What is my existential cry? What must I have to be fulfilled in this life? And then in your body, you show how in your life you have searched to fill this drive in many God-given legitimate ways. So we're not saying it necessarily has to be sinful or wrong, but it just isn't quite the thing that will fill this God-given drive. And then in the bridge moment, that's when you can mention the gospel. This is now where you can mention Jesus. Oh, it's Jesus I was looking for I just didn't know. It doesn't have to come like this crisis moment, but this is the grid. Then in the conclusion, you show how this is now real in your life. What does this look like to have Jesus in your life? And a denouement, final bit on what is the new me. Now that I have Jesus, what is a new me? What do I look like now I have Jesus? So I actually did grow up in a Christian family. I did know Jesus for as long as I can remember. There's been no moment where I said I did not know Jesus. I've been a Christian. I've been saved all my life. But often when I present in a mixed audience of believers and non-believers, someone will always ask, how did you become a Christian? And I've got an audience of 100 people waiting to hear this answer. So I usually say, well, look at me. I'm Asian, and I was first born in my family, so I'm a high achiever. And so my dad was a doctor, my brother is a doctor. For as long as I remember, I've always wanted to be a doctor. So that's my mission in life. I'm a high achiever. So what I need is achievement, trophies, status. So now you reveal a bit more about yourself in the body. So I was that annoying kid in primary school who was stuck up their hand and said, Miss, I finished my work, I need more work, please. I was, and then in high school, you get 99% in exam, and you think, where is the 1%? How did I lose one mark? And then, yes, I got into medicine, but then suddenly you realise it's not everything I thought it would be. You're actually only the bottom of the mountain. You're not on Everest. You're only on base camp because there's still another journey in medicine itself. And the problem with being a high achiever, you're only as good as your last success. You remember your failures more than your successes, and you suddenly realise you need the awards more for you than for the people around you. You actually are very proud and insecure at the same time, and you're surrounded by other proud and insecure people in this dog-eat-dog zero-sum game world where everyone's competing against each other rather than helping and complimenting each other. For example, I can remember I went to like 1,000 ward rounds as a doctor. But the one I remember the most is the one where they deliberately stuck up my x-ray with an operation that went wrong. And so one, you have these people trying to destroy you, but two, you're not as good as even you yourself think you are. And that's a problem being a high achiever. Now you give them the bridge moment, the gospel. All my life I've known about Jesus. Yes, I know he's the Son of God. Yes, I know if I believe in him, my sins are forgiven. Yes, I know I can have eternal life with Jesus in heaven, but I don't think I ever understood that he was perfect so I don't have to be perfect. When I was 16, my high school chaplain got us to read the Bible systematically, and that's when I read a book called Romans. I think that's when finally it dawned on me, Jesus is perfect so I don't have to be perfect. So God loves me just the way I am. I don't have to earn his love. I don't have to win his forgiveness. I don't have to merit his attention. If I know Jesus, he loves me just the way I am, but he loves me too much to leave me the way I am. And bit by bit, I'm on a journey where he makes me more and more like Jesus. Now, this didn't have... Now you come to the conclusion, show what this looks like in your life. This didn't become real to me until I was a junior doctor. Now, you can be a Christian and a doctor. You can serve God as a doctor. My dad does it, my brother does it. But for me, I was suddenly given this opportunity where people said, hey, you can actually tell people about Jesus as your full-time job. And that's something you're good at. And I'm thinking, now I have to choose between medicine and telling people about Jesus. And again, you can serve God as a doctor. But for me, this seemed the better opportunity and the better gifting and the better circumstances. And now I'm thinking, where does my value come from? Because when you're a doctor, it's so good to be a doctor as a high achiever, as an Asian high achiever. Parents want to know your parents. How did you get your kid to be a doctor? Bank managers want to know you. They want to lend you their money. And at dinner parties, everyone wants to talk to you. Oh, they want to show you their rashes. And now when you... Now when you tell people about Jesus, no one wants to know you. No one wants to talk to you at a dinner party. Bank managers do not ring you up. And suddenly you realise, well, I have to decide where my value comes from. If I have Jesus, it doesn't matter whether I have achieved, whether I have trophies, whether I have awards, whether I'm doctor or not. And so I had to have this moment where I said, you know what? If I have Jesus, I'm perfect in God's eyes, and they're the only eyes that count. because I was be imperfect in my own eyes and in other people's eyes, but Jesus is perfect for a high achiever. I am perfect because of Jesus, but God loves me too much to leave me perfect, so every day I have a journey, I have a mission to be more and more like Jesus. Then you can give them a little denouement moment. You know, I caught up with some of my old doctor friends. They had not seen me for maybe 10 or 20 years, and they said, "You have changed. You don't drive like a jerk anymore." So I didn't know I used to drive like a jerk, but apparently being a high achiever makes you drive like a jerk. And you don't dominate the conversation at dinner parties like you used to. So I don't realize I was so insecure as a high achiever. I need this need to get people to notice me. They say, "You are so much more secure." And that's it. As a high achiever, Jesus has allowed me to be humble and secure rather than proud and insecure. So that's like a 5-minute public version, and that's how I answer in public now. And I found, wow, people listened for the whole way through rather than had I said, "Well, I grew up in a Christian family," and you've lost them after that. And that means what we can do is we can use this grid and to come up with a 1-minute version, a 5-minute version, a 10-minute version. And of course, we're never going to get a chance to monologue it. But as a public speaker, I have a chance to monologue in a way you guys don't. So in these private conversations. But when someone says, "How did you become a Christian?" Your first line is, "Well, let me tell you about who I am." That's your first line. Let me tell you about who I am. So I have, when I handed this to my Bible college students, one guy, Damon Whittington, he spoke at KIC a few years ago. He says, "I'm adopted. I've been adopted. And so for my whole life, I've been looking for a family. I've had no belonging. Yes, my step-parents love me, but I've never found belonging in that family. So I've always been looking for belonging." So in high school, I look for it in the jocks, then I look for it in these people. And then he takes you to this bridge moment where he went on schoolies week. He thought he'd finally found belonging, but no, there was no belonging there. And that's when he remembered all the stuff he learned about Jesus that people had told him. He realized, if I have Jesus, God adopts me to be his child. And then he shares what life is like now as a son of God. So that was his grip. But his first thing he says would be, if you say, "Damien, how did you become a Christian?" Rather than take you immediately to, "Well, I was a schoolies week," he begins with, "Let me tell you about me. I'm adopted. I'm an adopted child. So for my whole life, I've been just wondering who my parents are. I have no belonging. My step family love me, but there's no real belonging there." So he takes you on that journey. So and another girl, I remember, she sat there with a blank page like for an hour. She says, "I've got nothing to say. I grew up in a Christian family. I've got nothing to say." I said, "Well, you've got to just tell me who you are. Who are you? What drives you?" And then finally she said, "I'm a pastor's kid." That's her identity. "I'm a pastor's kid. So for my whole life, I've had to live up to the expectations of other people. In Sunday school, I had to be the perfect kid. I could never get an answer wrong in Sunday school." So she takes you on this journey, what it's like to be a pastor's kid, always having to live to please other people. And then she can tell you how, but when you find Jesus, that doesn't have to happen anymore. And now she can be secure in who she is without worrying about being a people pleaser and letting other people down. So she began this thing by saying, "I'm a pastor's kid and I'm a people pleaser." Do you see how that works? And so then maybe what we can do for homework now is think, well, who am I? And it will take an hour. So you got the answer in 5 minutes. That is not your real answer. That came too quickly. So in an hour, who am I? What drives me? What are my hopes? What are my dreams? What are my ambitions? And from that, I can have a story. Because really, when someone asks you, tell me about your faith, they're not just asking what you believe, but what life with Jesus is like. That's really what they're asking. How does this work in your life? How is it real in your life? Not what are the propositions to believe. Jesus is the Son of God. He died for me. My sins are forgiven. I will have eternal life. They're propositional things where Jesus is really just a bullet point. But how is Jesus a person in our life? That's what we need to tell them. Because I remember my missionary friend from China, he says, whenever he hears my talks about Jesus, he says, "Sam, I feel like you're giving me Jesus as a proposition. I still don't feel like I met him as a person." And maybe that's what we need to work on. How can people meet Jesus as a person when we tell them our story? So that's number 5. Learn to tell our story as a story, where we come across as real, existential and experiential. And then maybe number six then, my final point is, tell Jesus as a story. So maybe there will be a chance where after they've asked us, how did you become a Christian? When it finishes, you can say, oh, you know what? Can I tell you a story about Jesus? Can I tell you a story about Jesus? And that might help you understand why he's real in my life. And that's where all you have to do now is find your favourite story about Jesus that complements something in your life, which is real for you, as a story. And you don't have to memorise the Bible word for word, because the Bible itself is not word for word from the Bible. It's an English translation from the original Greek. If we had to give them the Bible word for word, technically we'd have to memorise the Greek or the Hebrew. The fact that we're already using English translations means we're very happy with paraphrases, because that's what translations are. And so you just pick your own favourite Bible story, paraphrase it, tell it as a story. So for a high achiever, a good story is a story of the Pharisee and the tax collector. He said, let me tell you a story that Jesus himself told. He said, a very religious man and a very unworthy, shameful man both went to a temple once to pray, hoping to get right with God. And the religious leader basically prayed, dear God, look at how amazing I am. I come to church more than I have to. I pray more than I have to. I'm generous with my money. I've never cheated on my wife. I'm a family man. I'm moral. I'm upright. I'm respected. At least I'm not like, you know, thieves, these robbers, these adulterers. People do cheat on their wives. People cheat on their taxes. At least I'm not like that. And then Jesus says, but the other man, who was very non-religious, who was very shameful, he prayed to God, dear God, have mercy on me. And then Jesus says, this man went home right with God, not the other one, but this man went home right with God, because for God, whoever tries to lift themselves up before God, God will humble, but whoever humbles himself before God, God will lift up. And see, he's perfect. And then straight after this story, this is the most amazing thing that happened. People brought all these children to try to see Jesus. And everyone thought, Jesus isn't going to want to see children. So they kept trying to keep the children away from Jesus. And Jesus said, whoa, 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 let the children come. Let them come. Because unless we become like these children, we're not going to ever, ever enter God's kingdom. And that's where this rich man came up to Jesus. Hey, Jesus, what do I need to do to have eternal life? And Jesus said, well, you know the commandments, follow all the commandments in the Bible. And the guy said, I've done all the commandments in the Bible. And then Jesus said, well, you still need to do one thing. You need to sell all your riches and give them away to the poor and then come follow me. And the man couldn't do it because he was too rich. And that's when everyone thought, well, who can be saved? If the rich man can't be saved, who can be saved? Jesus says, yeah, it's right. It's really hard to be saved. It's impossible, but with God, things are possible. Then one of Jesus' followers said, but we gave up everything to follow you. And Jesus says, yeah, whoever gives up everything to follow me, God will pay back 100 times in this life and the life to come. And that's when there was this blind man and he cried out to Jesus, you know, make me see, make me see. And Jesus opened his eyes and he could see. And actually what that whole story is actually justification by faith. You know, but in story form, if you think about it. So you're telling the story about the Pharisee and tax collector. You're right by faith. And then you have to become like children. That's justification by faith. And you're not going to be saved by works. That's the rich man. And in the end, you're just going to need Jesus to open your eyes a bit more and see. That's actually the whole story. And then what you do, you don't have to tell all of that. So I'm giving you the expanded form. But you find a story that you like. It could be the woman washing Jesus' feet. I find that it's a really good story because that disarms people. I like to tell the story of these people worked in the vineyard all day. Some worked 12 hours, some worked only one, but they still got given the same amount. What's going on there? That really disarms people. Isn't that a bit unfair? And then the owner actually says, who are you calling unfair? It's my money. I can do whatever I want with it. are you just offended? I'm so generous with what I have. So that really disarms people. But you're going to find your story that resonates the most with you, that you just love telling to compliment your story. And then afterwards, all you have to say, hey, what did you like about the story? That's all you have to say. Don't, and then whatever they say, don't disagree. Don't say, oh, you're wrong. No, I think you should have liked this instead. No, no. What you're doing is you're asking them safe questions where there are no wrong answers. And they don't have to please you by trying to guess the answer in your head. So then you say, well, what did you like in the story? And if there's permission to go on, and they're not just trying to blow you off, oh, I like the way you used your hands or something like that. No, no, no. What in the story did you like? Well, what do you think this story teaches us about Jesus? What did you learn about Jesus in the story? Is the next safe one? Or is there anything you don't understand in the story? That's a safe question because there's no wrong answer to that. And just see where that goes. And so again, I'm trying to make it sound so formulaic, but we know in life it's more an art than a science. But what I'm showing you, it's actually little baby steps. So often we've been taught to memorize things, and in real life there is no real opportunity where we pull out a track. That just isn't what seems to happen in our Western world anymore. And so these are just more organic ways of telling our friends about Jesus. So let's sum up what I've said. Number one, we have to merge our universes. It's a lifestyle change. It's not an event we tack on into our lives. We need to get our Christian friends to become friends with our non-Christian friends. We need to merge our universes. Number two, we need to start going to non-Christian things with our non-Christian friends so that they will come to our Christian things when we invite them. Go to their things before they can come to our things. Three, the coffee dinner gospel. Understand we're in an unofficial closed country. There are ways we can work against it, and we should, but there are also ways we can work with it. So one way we can work with our culture is understand why gospel conversations don't happen at lunchtime, because you're in public safe space. So more and more we need to get people into private space. And hospitality, I think, is a bigger part, a more and more important thing. So one of my, let me share, I shouldn't share new material in a summary, I know, but one of my friends who was a doctor who did become a Christian, years later said, you know what I loved about flashing with you? And I thought, oh, he's going to mention, you know how we used to go to music or restaurants or do this. He goes, I love how you used to invite me back to your place for dinner, like with my own family. And so for a non-Christian, they're just blown away by family meal. We actually forget how evangelistic a family meal is because no one's doing it anymore. And so now they see Christianity, the gospel, at work in a family meal. And so I think hospitality is one of the big silver bullets in evangelism in the 21st century because people just don't do it anymore. So hospitality shows the gospel at work. If we have a family that's functioning, that's so evangelistic. People are just blown away. Wow, parents eating with children? What is with that? Like, how is that even happening? And then it also is private space where people feel more and more comfortable about talking about values and worldviews and maybe their gospel opportunities. And then number four was listen to their story. Number five was learn to tell our story as a story, where we come across as real and Jesus comes across as real. And number six, learn to tell Jesus as a story. So one of my big premises is I think more and more in the 21st century, it really is a journey into belief. I just read the autobiography of Rosario Butterfield, who is a feminist, lesbian academic. And the more you read, realize there was no one moment that did it for her. It was a journey. C.S. Lewis, when you read his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, there was no one moment that did it for him. And I think there's no one moment that's going to do it for our non-Christian friends. It's more about just being there and being part of one of the many events and one of the many people that will be part of this person's life. Jesus said, you know, the harvest is plentiful, but he didn't say go. He does say go in other places, but he says pray that God will send people into their lives. So then, and we're one of the many people, but we're not the only people in these people's lives. So let me share how one of my friends did become a Christian. So he was one of my flatmates, totally non-Christian past, Buddhist background, no Christians in his family, very happy, fulfilled man as well. Like, he was popular, he was humble, no real issues going in his life, no need for crisis conversion, just flatting with me. But bit by bit, he met my Christian friends. We would hang out together for about 2 years. And he slowly asked me more and more questions in the flat. So often we used to love just sitting on a balcony by ourselves late at night, just listening to music, feeling sorry for ourselves, two single guys on a Friday night. And I don't think I ever explicitly explained the gospel to him, like from start to finish, ever. There was no beginning, end moment. But little things like he'd say, "What is this Jesus thing all about?" And I said, "Well, look at us. Two guys on a balcony on a Friday night feeling sorry for ourselves when really we'll just love to find someone and settle down in a place called home." Well, that's what it's like to know Jesus. We find Jesus, we settle down with Jesus in a place that God calls home. I think that was the most explicit I ever was. He chased a Christian girlfriend, a girl at a hospital. She turned him down, said, "I can't date you. You're not a Christian." So he comes to me and says, "What is going on? Why can't she date me if I'm not a Christian?" So that led to more opportunities. And then about 2 years in, he, on a Friday night, one of his rituals was you catch up with all his old university friends, drive into the city, play cards, have a good time, have a few drinks. So he went out, I said, "Have a good time." He comes back 5 minutes later, I said, "What's going on? Why aren't you going to your thing with your friends?" He said, "Oh, I got in my car and this spider crawled across my windscreen. I hate spiders, so I got my shoe out and bang, I killed it. And that just shattered the whole windscreen. So now I can't go anywhere." And then he said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to a Bible study with my church friends." And there's silence. I said, "Well, do you want to come?" He goes, "Yeah." So he came along, he started coming to Bible study, and he slowly started coming to church. I don't know if there was one real moment where he converted, but bit by bit, he was a Christian. He got baptized. He still is a Christian. So that was 20 years ago, still attending church in Brisbane now. And if I was to ask him what was the key moment, he said it was the dinner with my parents. That's where it all became real for him, which I never would have expected. So I think it really is a journey. We need to invest, but not over-invest into one moment. I think it's one of many moments. So the days where you give the gospel in a 20-minute talk, people pray a prayer, I think we forget about the years that led up to someone praying that prayer. And I am often fortunate enough to be the guy that gives that 20-minute talk and asks people to make a decision. But for them to make that decision, a lot of work has gone in from God and friends and family investing in that person's life. All right, I might break for lunch, and after lunch, you can ask me some question and answer based on what we've talked about.